Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Thomas Crow. He is the Rosalie Solow Professor of Modern Art at New York University's Institute of Fine Arts. And tonight we're talking about his new book, Murder in the Rue Marat, A Case of Art in Revolution. Thomas, welcome to the show. It is a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Mark.
What I love about this book is you focus on one image, and if people are skeptical about you could write an entire book about one image, this will dispel that skepticism because there's so much that you can say. We're talking about Jacques-Louis David's The Death of Marat is one of the names for it, and people should call that image up while they're listening because it's a famous painting. I always thought it was an odd painting. And you've written an entire book about it. But first, in your introductory chapters, or as you call it, the scene-setting prologue.
Okay.
The first time you noticed this image was in a rock poster for Moby Grape.
Indeed, it was. when I was in college, when I saw that poster, I had an interest in art, but not very much knowledge about it. I wasn't majoring in art history. And whether I'd seen a reproduction of the original, I can't really recall. But even in that kind of rough and ready ink translation of it that this artist, Bob Wilson, did for a rock poster, it just had a kind of strength and sort of mystery about it. Then I know stuck in my mind, and I could immediately, of course, correlate it with the great play,
right,
which we abbreviate as Marat/Sade, which had been a huge sensation in the years just before.
It's amazing. A lot of things seem to coalesce around the death of Marat at that time, mm-hmm. And as you write about, Judy Collins had a whole section from the film Marat Sade on one of her early albums.
Yeah, and it opened the side and was very intense in a kind of, Bertolt Brecht, Kurt Weill kind of style. And here was this character, Marat, being called out, by the singers, addressed by the singers. And Marat, we're poor. Marat, we can't wait anymore. We want a revolution. We want it now. And, given the times and the protests against the war and so on, it really was startling. And it kind of led down the path that ultimately got to this book so many decades later.
So had this book always been cooking in the back of your mind?
It has. I mean, not from that first encounter. But when I did decide to become an art historian, and I did go to graduate school in art history, I had this idea that you might be able to write a whole dissertation on a single painting. And if you could, it would be this one.
It's fascinating what you bring together in the introduction to the book, because it really captures that time period. And most of the people listening have no idea what that time period was about, the 1960s into the early 70s. But you bring in people like Artie Lang and Claude Lévi-Strauss and all sorts of other things. And all of that relates in a way to Marat Sade and then back to the painting. And by the way, I want to mention that you were a poster artist at the time, too. You did a poster, you reproduced it in this book, and you idolized Rick Griffin, one of the great poster makers.
Indeed, that was my big art commitment at the time to the wonderful graphic design and illustration that, that the 1960s and the psychedelic ballrooms and so on brought out. And, that got me thinking along the visual rather than, the dry textual way of understanding the world. And then I've followed that thread to where I was thinking about art across the board and what I would do in it, and that was my first idea.
It's interesting. You also looked at a canvas, a 2002 canvas by the Chinese artist. I'm going to mispronounce this. Yu Minjun?
Yeah, that's which, Yu Minjun.
Where he takes his painting, The Death of Murat, and he essentially erases the human figure. And your book begins with that as one of the analysis points. And it's a very weird effect, if you're familiar with the art of the painting, when you see Murat taken out of it.
Yeah, it refocuses mm-hmm. the painting. It doesn't, you know, replace it, but it just gives you another way to look at it and think about it. And it was done in, as you said, in 2002. And when I saw it, you know, all grown up, art history professor, everything, it just reminded me of those first ideas that I had, which were to take the painting and somehow subtract and change it so that you could see the different layers or, you know, networks of meaning separately from each other before you then put them all back together again.
And one of the other things that this book, your book does is that it really gives the historical political background to the painting. And that's important for many of us who saw Murat's Sade. We had no, I mean, we might have read about the French Revolution, but we had no idea who Murat was.
Yes, indeed. And it's not a bad introduction, even though, as your listeners may not remember or ever have been exposed to, the main characters in the story of Murat's murder and the contemporary revolutionary moment are played by actors imitating psychiatric patients.
That's right. At Charenton.
So it's filtered through these different kinds of behaviors. Charlotte Corday suffers from narcolepsy.
Played by Glenda Jackson.
Yes, it was for her first big role. And so for all her lines and actions, she has to be woken up.
Right. And it's under the direction of Marquis de Sade.
Yeah.
Who was imprisoned there.
He, in fact, was imprisoned there. He did little productions of plays he'd written, which the rather enlightened director of the asylum encouraged as something that would be, you know, have a healing sort of effect on his charges. Not that he ever did one on the death of Murat, but that was what the playwright, Peter Weiss, took off from and came up with this extraordinary synthesis of so many elements, both of the time of where the play is set and also the period in which Weiss was writing.
What's fascinating is the play itself was also revolutionary.
Yes, indeed.
And this incredible chaotic ending to the play. I think people referred to it originally as Theater of Cruelty or something like that.
I think it descends from that. The Theater of Cruelty had been around for a little while as an idea, but this sort of took it mainstream and out of the particularly French context, you know, into a very international one. I mean, you mentioned that you saw the film version in its very first run.
Yeah, and it was not like anything I'd ever seen before, because it had this, you're watching a film of a play about a play, and so it's got all those levels that totally break down at the end, and it's also a comment on revolution, and you're at the time, especially in the United States, you're talking about revolution a lot. It was quite an experience, but I never knew who Murat was at that time. Like, let's explain for the benefit of the audience who Jean-Paul Murat was.
Well, he was a very complicated figure. There is a huge new biography to be published tomorrow.
Whoa.
By a great French historian, Keith Baker. If you want to find out, I think, everything you want to know about Jean-Paul Murat. He had been a kind of scientist and then a very liberationist left-wing political thinker. He'd lived in England for a long time. He ended up being the official physician to the king's brother. And then after 1789, as the revolution got going, he completely went that way and functioned as a polemical journalist, putting out his journal, you know, on a incessant basis, calling out the people he saw as enemies of the revolution, encouraging the so-called sans-culottes, who were the working class activists of the revolution, and adopting this name for both himself and his newsletter, the Friend of the People.
And that's actually in the painting.
Yes, it is. The artist, David, who was very friendly with Marat, and that wasn't true for every revolutionary. He was a difficult person. But David sympathized with him and visited him regularly and saw him in much the posture, you know, of, well, this is another peculiarity of Marat's later life, is that he suffered from a terrible skin condition that required him to spend most of the day in a soothing bath. And that's where he is in the painting. That's where Charlotte Corday had to gain entry in order to commit the murder.
And she did, in fact, stab him.
Yes.
Mightily. Now, what,
you know,
she...
With one stroke, she severed his carotid artery, and he died almost instantly.
I think one of the amazing things I learned in your book is that the missive that he was working on is still preserved with his blood on it.
Yes, that, well, I discovered that. I hadn't known that, you know, through all my decades of interest in Marat and the painting. I came across what seems to be an absolutely valid document of the murder. So pages of his journal that he seemed to be reading at the time that she entered.
So, Thomas, who owns this historical document with his bloodstains?
It's in the collection of the National Library of France.
Wow.
It came in with a set of papers from a collector, and his handwriting's all over the top of it, which is kind of a shame. You know, then people, you know, gradually woke up to what they had. And, you know, you can even see the pattern of, you know, how the blood gushed over the thing that he was writing on top of.
Well, that's one of the interesting things you bring out in the book is the difference between David's painting and it, and the blood in it, and there is blood in it, and the actual murder scene, which where there was apparently gore all over the place.
Well, that is what the witnesses, and they were right on the scene, right after it happened, including several medical men who then attested to what had happened later. So we have very good documents of what happened. And when you just think about the fact that it was that the artery was severed in one stroke, you know, the presence of blood in the real scene would have been like one of those old samurai movies with blood just everywhere. And it's not something that David could have included without turning it into, you know, a sort of gory spectacle, which is not at all what he wanted.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Thomas Crowe. He is the Rosalie Solo Professor of Modern Art at New York University's Institute of Fine Arts, and we're talking about his new book, Murder in the Rue Marat, A Case of Art in Revolution. Thomas, you essentially, throughout this book, create a gallery, an art gallery, of separate works, each to be considered in turn, and a lot of it, we should give credit to where credit to do, is Dominica Avanica.
Dominica Sirota, who was a graduate student where I teach at NYU, and proved to have, I was advising her on her studies, but she proved to have a great ability in manipulating in a photographic manipulation program so that we could alter the painting at will.
It's
even, you know, sit there together and we'd make a change and look at it and she could change it back. And
wow.
So it was a really interesting aspect of the project.
Well, let's take the first aspect. And it's really funny when you look at the work, there's no objects in the work whatsoever. There's only the trace of the line of the division between the foreground, which has all the objects and Marat in it, and the very odd background, which has no detail whatsoever. The line separating the foreground and the background and is very odd because of its similarities to another work. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that was something that I think I can take credit for having first recognized a very long time ago, mentioned it in an earlier book, but didn't really pursue it very far. And as I've thought about the possibilities, you know, ever since, it's come to signify really the total structure of the painting in a single spidery line that separates the bottom half from the top half, which when you really just look at it in that way, you can see that the empty top half and the very full, burnished, populated lower half are exactly the same size. So David seems to be wanting us to draw some equivalency between them, the here and now, and something which is unspecific, possibility, the future. There's a slight glow in the upper right-hand corner as if you're looking in that direction. And I think that has a lot to do with the sense of possibility that the revolution was holding on to, was threatened at every turn. And I think that's one of the things that makes the painting as profound as it is.
But it's also the same boundary that exists in a painting by one of his pupils of a Pietà.
Yes, yeah, you brought that up, and I sort of rushed past it.
And that's extraordinary. And I wouldn't have gotten that unless you had done these superimpositions and reductions.
Yes, exactly. The pupil was called Anne-Louis Girodet. That's a male name in French. And he had been given a commission. He was a young artist just emerging from David's tutelage. And he got a commission to do an enormous Pietà, that is, the Virgin Mary mourning over her dead son in her lap. The famous sculpture by Michelangelo in St. Peter's is that subject. And Girodet interpreted this Pietà as a painting, a very common subject, but he interpreted it in a very radical way. He set it in the cave of the tomb of Christ and spent as much of the surface of the painting on the blank stone wall as he did on the two holy figures at the bottom, with almost exactly the same boundary pattern that then David lifted and used to track the tabletop and then the shoulders and head of Marat.
I find that extraordinary.
It's a different way of translating one painting into another, which I thought was so extraordinary, almost having to do with a sort of information transfer as much as anything else.
Well, that brings up the question, are we to understand David's painting as sort of turning Marat into a religious figure, like a Christ-like figure?
Well, that was a commonplace at the time. People said that. Even that Marat had been superior to Christ in his selfless devotion to the poor, because religion and Catholicism in general were you know, being suppressed in many places and being rejected as instruments of the old order and means of domination of the population. So the core of it, you know, which had been somewhat discredited, was in fact revived and given new life in this purely secular version that David had done, but with all the feeling that religion had invested that particular dyad of, you know, of mother and martyr together, but condensed into one figure rather than two.
And it's, as you write in the book, and I think you might be quoting somebody else, nearly all of David's artistic decisions contributed to making Marat's memorial, this painting, a plea for calm rather than an incitement to retribution.
Yeah, I think that's me.
Okay.
Yes.
Because it seemed like it'd be an amazing time for the two factions to really go into battle with each other.
You know, we're looking at a period notoriously called the Terror.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't really begun yet. People generalize the idea of the Terror too broadly over the history of the Revolution. It had its fairly specific chronological markers. And indeed, I think Charlotte Corday's murder of Marat and the idea that really all revolutionaries were now targets of assassination made for a very hard line against anyone they viewed as a potential counter-revolutionary, and helped bring the Terror about, which really didn't get going at any scale until a couple of months after the assassination. The plea for calm, which really was coming from the very top, from Maximilien Robespierre, the leader of the left-wing faction and the government of the time. And what he was trying to bring about was a transfer of the sort of franchise for violence and insurrection from the spontaneous groups of, as I said, sans-culottes, the working-class militants, get them disciplined and trusting the revolution to carry out their desires for retribution on their behalf. And so Marat was their hero. And so if you see Marat as more pacified than the government's irrigation or taking over that mission to eliminate the enemies of the revolution is more emotionally palatable, I think.
We're going to run out of time, and we've only started to talk about this book. But there's all these objects, and one of the great works in your personal gallery about this painting is that you eliminate everything except the objects, and you write that it functions as a implicit, these material items function as an implicit testimony bearing on the crime and its perpetrator. It's like a CSI.
Yes, indeed. It's, you know, I use the word forensic fairly often in the book, and that's that there is a very forensic aspect to the painting. That is, that it's not just a propaganda declaration. It invites the viewer in to figure out the crime. I mean, you know what it is already, but to sort of figure out how it came about in detail and what traces and clues it left. So I, you know, made that punning title for the book based on
The Murder in Rue Morgue.
Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
And Poe was the inventor of the detective story.
I just watched that movie like this weekend.
Yes.
We're going to run out of time, but I just want to talk. There's in the epilogue, you write that the 1960s were perhaps the last great era of common reading. Can you just talk one or two sentences about that? Because that really struck me.
Well, I remember everybody had the same paperbacks.
Yep.
And they were all about rediscovering ourselves or, you know, or protesting the existing conditions of life. Frantz Fanon for rebellion and
the wretched of the earth. The wretched of the earth of.
Sorry, go ahead.
Was in everybody's dorm room when I went to Clark.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were about 20 titles that I think just about everybody who was in that mindset, in the sort of countercultural or mobilization against the war, the student revolt, you know, everyone who was in or sympathetic to those things had these books, and they became a sort of blueprint for a different way of living. And, you know, things that were not written down, like the play, like Peter Weiss's play, also figured in this, I think.
It was a common experience that we saw. We're out of time, but I want to mention the same's true for the music at the time, too. Everybody had the same albums.
Oh, yeah, completely. And we were talking about Love, Arthur Lee, leader of Love, quoting.
That's right.
Assad.
We're all normal, and we want our freedom.
Our freedom. And when the inmates arise and overwhelm the authority that had been contained.
That's what they chant. We're out of time. I could talk about this book for hours.
Thank you.
My guest tonight is Thomas Crowe. He is the Rosalie Solo Professor of Modern Art at New York University's Institute of Fine Arts. And tonight, we've been talking about his new book, All About One Painting. And it's an amazing revelation. Murder in the Rue Marat, a case of art in revolution.
Well, thank you very much,
Thomas. It's been a pleasure.
Very stimulating and sympathetic conversation.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.